That's true.
Right.
If you give it to them, or the,
Okay.
And you go refer it something there.
I'm gonna refer it to you. Who's your neighbor?
Sarah Dressen, she's a, she's like.
Now, which one are we gonna go to after that?
I would just want to do the sunsets.
Okay.
Are we sending the tax credit ones forward?
Actually, I may move down and do this one next.
Hey.
Who's that? Okay. Welcome, everybody, to the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation. For the record, it's March 8th, 2017. We're gonna start off today with a public hearing on Senate Bill 645. So we're open on that, and Patrick.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 645 expands the definition of vehicle of special interest to include Humvees. We have no amendment for this measure. It has a minimal fiscal impact, but we do not have a revenue impact statement on this, Mr. Chair, as of yet.
Okay. I think we got everybody up there. Senator!
Thank you, Chair Beyer. Colleagues, I'm Senator Fred Girard. I represent Senate District 9. Colleagues, once in a while, we get a constituent bill that makes a lot of sense. This one is one of those. It's a very simple bill. It adds Humvees to the special interest designation for registration. Humvee owners have a hard time driving their car on the road. This just allows them access, a special access, to like parades and limited use. It's a good bill. It just adds Humvees right now. It's for antique cars, and so this was the way that we decided to go. But the person that gave me the idea is Hank Porter, who sits next to me, and he'll kind of give you a little bit of reasoning why he wants the bill.
Welcome, sir.
Thank you. Senator Girard and Chair Beyer, gentlemen, I'm Hank Porter. I live in Staten. Let's see, this summer it will be 49 years there, so kind of
we kind of
dug ourselves in. And about a year ago, my son and I bought three of these things from an outfit called GovPlanet that was took a contract to sell 4,000 of these to the public at auction. Over the, I think they started in December of 14, so it's 2 years and a little more into this sale. They're sold all over the country, and they do come with a disclaimer that says they're for off-road use only. But that's kind of a thing that the manufacturer, AM General, which was a subsidiary of AMC, American Motors Corporation, they kind of did that to make sure that these things in public hands were not competing with their commercial sales, because they were building these things for commercial sales at the same time they were building the military ones. So that seems to be the reason why they are sort of banned at state Department of Vehicles, Motor Vehicles. I wanted the thing, and just to use for parades to haul around old veterans, also the commander of the local Veterans of Foreign Wars chapter out there, and so many of our members they're just not into walking a couple of miles in a 4th of July parade and other events that promote VFW and the American Legion. And I thought this was kind of the perfect rig. It had room for four people in them. And if you put benches in the back, probably about eight. So that was my motivation for trying to get the thing licensed. At some level, and this seemed to be. I've had special event plates on two other rigs that my son and I built, a World War II Dodge pickup and a World War II half track, and they went down the road with those yellow plates on them. So that's my motivation, and that's really. maybe that's probably enough to say about it.
Yeah.
Are there any questions, anything? Oh, excuse me.
Mr. Honeycutt, you want to comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Dave Honeycutt, I'm not here on behalf of Oregon Indians in Action or the Oregon Mining Association today. I'm just here on my own behalf. I had a member call me early in the session and with the same problem that Mr. Porter has indicated. If you find a Humvee bill that can help me out of my situation, then please go down and see if you can help get it passed. Well, lo and behold, Senator Girod has a Humvee bill that would help my member out of his situation. So I'm here to say I like the bill, and it makes a lot of sense to me, and I would urge the committee to move it along and send it on its way to the floor.
Questions? I guess I have one. The bill is drafted, defines it as a special interest vehicle, which, according to the DMV rules, means that you can't use it for general use on roads, but only for special events and so forth. Mm-hmm. That's an understanding that works?
Certainly.
Okay, cool. As long as we have that. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, sir.
Amy?
Chair Beyer and members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation on this bill, representing the DMV. We're neutral on the bill. Just putting a little bit of stuff on the record, and we submitted some documentation as well. Mr. Porter indicated, when a person purchases one of these Humvee military surplus vehicles, they sign a waiver agreement, understanding that it's not for road use, and the title itself is stamped not for road use, which results in the DMV not permitting it to be registered. As indicated by the other folks, this would provide that special interest vehicle or vehicle of special interest designation. It's a permanent registration, $81, and they have it forever. And again, as Chair Beyer, you noted, use for use in parades and things of that ilk, not for general driving on the road. The reason that it's generally not for road use is it wasn't built for roadworthiness, and therefore that's why it's not built for general purpose operation on the road. That's all I have.
Okay, questions? Amy, we don't have a revenue or a fiscal impact. I'm just curious, do you see it as having either?
Senator Byron, no.
Okay. All righty. Thank you. Oops, I'm sorry. Senator Monroe.
Hi, Amy.
Hello, Senator.
If these vehicles were licensed by you, could they somehow be restricted to only parades and things, or could we find them out on the regular road mixing with other traffic?
Chair Beyer and Senator Monroe, the statutes around vehicles of special interest, what they allow for is things like parades, which are a very controlled atmosphere. It also then allows for things like club activities. And what we've seen sometimes is a locality will have a car club, Camaros, T-Birds, whatever, and they'll do drives or something like that. So it is possible that they could have a car club event, and it would, in theory, fall under that.
And under that circumstance, we might find these out with mixed traffic on the regular roads and streets and highways?
Chair Beyer, Senator Monroe, yeah, I think that's possible under the law.
Thank you.
Thank you, Amy.
Thank you.
That's all I had signed up. Does anybody else wish to testify on this? Well, we don't have the fiscal or the revenue, so we can't move it today, but I didn't see any objections. So we will close public hearing on Senate Bill 645, and we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 778.
Joey.
Please.
All right. Patrick. Senate Bill 778, Mr. Chair, requires the Department of Transportation to pay just compensation for outdoor advertising signs that are removed, blocked, damaged, destroyed, or lost as a result of highway construction. It defines just compensation for purposes of the measure, and it directs the department to design work on highways so as to protect outdoor advertising signs from being blocked, damaged, destroyed, or lost as a result of the construction. This measure has no amendment. At this point, we have received a statement of no revenue impact, but we do not have the fiscal impact statement on this measure. It's possible we will get it before the end of the hearing, I'm told, but we do not currently have it yet, Mr. Chair.
All righty. So, Mr. Barrows, Mr. Dura?
Gerva.
And then I have Brian Cassidy and Chris Zukin. Do you guys want to come up separately? I see you're both from Meadow Outdoor.
Yeah, we could have Mr. Zukin come up at the end. Mr. Chair, I appreciate it. Afternoon.
Hi.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Tom Barrows, representing Oregon Outdoor Advertising Association. I also represent Pacific Outdoor, which has an interest in this bill. We're here to urge your support of Senate Bill 778, which would provide that ODOT give just compensation to a sign company if they require that the sign be moved due to construction. And the goal of this bill is not to have signs taken down but and get money from ODOT, but to rather incentivize them to work with us to keep signs up when possible. We've been working with ODOT for, well, I think Mr. Zukin will talk about for 10 years on this issue, but on this particular legislation, we've been working with ODOT for about 3 years trying to come up with something that we can all agree on. We did not bring this in the 2015 session in order to take more time to work on it. Currently, ODOT compensates sign companies by valuing the sign as personal property, while at the same time, the Department of Revenue taxes them as real property, bringing a fairness question into this. We also understand that Washington, California, and Idaho all have similar laws in place for compensation and provide for market value compensation. Similar to
the proposed bill?
Yes, I'm sorry. Yes, Mr. Chair. Finally, there's a U.S. Supreme Court case, Horn versus the Department of Agriculture, which has ruled that the government's required to pay just compensation when it takes property, whether personal or real. It's assumed that the next time that there's a valuable sign that comes down, the sign company impacted would probably sue under that and very likely when we think unquestionably win, which could potentially cost ODOT more money as well as drag out the time frame for whatever project it is. We think that 778 would provide a fair and predictable resolution to the problem and would reduce the need for costly litigation. We hope you can support it.
Okay. Thank you. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Dan Druva. I'm the general manager for Pacific Outdoor Advertising Company. Pacific Outdoor is based in Portland, where we currently employ 26 local folks there. I'm here to support Senate Bill 778. Outdoor advertising signs in Oregon are highly regulated. It's one of the few states that has a cap and replace system, which over time has resulted in fewer signs across the state, and subsequently those signs becoming increased in value to the sign companies that own them. Mm-hmm. From time to time, our signs, like other property, can be impacted by public projects, and in these cases, billboard companies would always prefer, as Mr. Barrows just said, to retain their signs whenever possible. This is our business, which is a tried and true advertising medium, over 100 years old, and it allows us to employ our hardworking, tax-paying Oregonians. Currently, when the Highway Department undergoes a project that impacts a sign, the sign companies are not taken into consideration until late in that project. SB 778 would assist ODOT or other public entities acquiring property for public projects to work with sign owners to find suitable relocation areas within a project, and if none can be found, to justly compensate the sign company for its loss of property. Payment of just compensation for signs taken in such projects is the current federal highway guideline. However, ODOT chooses to interpret its code to treat signs as personal property, offering a fraction of the real market value for signage. This despite the fact that, as Mr. Barrows said, that signs are treated as real property, taxes by the Department of Revenue. Ultimately, we believe that Oregon needs to be in line with federal guidelines in the treatment of outdoor advertising signs in these circumstances, just like our neighboring states, and I hope that we can have your support of the bill. Thank you.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Brian Cassidy from The Dalles, Oregon. I'm with Meadow Outdoor Advertising, and I'm here in support of Senate Bill 778. Thanks for the opportunity to speak to you. I believe that SB 778 is good for Oregon. It is fair, and as such, corrects what is an unjust practice related to the acquisition of outdoor advertising signs for public projects in Oregon. I want to provide some background information based on my experiences with ODOT takings in order to provide context for the proposed bill and for what you're hearing today. In the past 10 years, ODOT has taken four of my company's signs for highway projects around the state. The total value of these signs was $285,680 based on their real market value. Meadow was compensated $84,979.22 for these signs by ODOT as payment of the depreciated value of the sign structures, and in one case, a small legal settlement. Meadow has been damaged by the current system of acquisition by over $200,000. In addition to these takings, in the past 10 years, Meadow has relocated two sign structures for an ODOT highway project. We were able to move the signs because local code did not prohibit the construction of outdoor advertising signs, and because the person who owned the land was happy to work with us to place the signs further back on the portion of the property not being acquired by ODOT. The cost of the relocations of the sign was $97,724. In a court settlement, ODOT paid the relocation cost plus legal fees of $42,000. The kicker in all of this is that if the proposed legislation had been in place 10 years ago, of the six displaced signs, four could have remained at their existing location. One of the signs that was taken could have been relocated on the same parcel at a cost of $39,000, and only one sign that could not have been relocated would have been acquired through the payment of just compensation in the amount of $19,680. In summary, under the proposed legislation, ODOT could have spent only $58,680 instead of $225,000 that they paid out to Meadow, and my company would have been made whole. Thanks for your consideration of this bill, and I'm open to any questions you have about the process of relocations or acquisitions.
So I want to ask you a question. The department's testimony says that when a sign needs to be moved, it says the state pays to take down the sign, pays for the search for a new site, pays to transport the sign, pays for permits, pays to reinstall the sign, and pays to bring it up to code even if it were not so at the prior site. Do you agree with that?
Based on my experience, ODOT will pay $2,500 for relocation search expenses. What we are told when a sign is acquired is that we will be compensated at the lesser of the depreciated value of the sign structure or the cost to relocate it. And it, almost invariably, the lesser of those two amounts ends up being the depreciated value of the sign structure.
Same experience?
Yes, I haven't directly dealt with ODOT in a taking in the 10 years that I've been in this position with this company, but so I can't speak directly to.
So tell me your experience in Washington State, or what was the other state you referenced?
California and Idaho.
California. How does it work there?
We have a few signs in California, and when they're taken, they are appraised by typically somebody hired by the state to appraise the sign, and at its at fair market value, and then that's the amount that they pay.
You're correct. So I have some experience with that in California, not in Washington, but just compensation is defined as we're attempting to lay out in the proposed bill here, where the definition of the of value is real market value, so an arm's length transaction, what somebody would be willing to pay in cash. And that's already in the Oregon statute right now, but ODOT is referring to the personal property rather than real property.
Okay. Other questions? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Oh, let's see. Amy.
She might as well just have a lease on that seat back there.
Chair Beyer and members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation, today representing our highway division, the right-of-way section. And if you're wondering why I'm the ODOT representative on this kind of a bill, which isn't my typical, it's because I cut my teeth at ODOT running the sign program for 4 years and have continued to do the legislative liaison work since I left that position. And I will start by saying that I believe the department has a good and positive relationship with the industry. And so I don't think there's any animosity either way, as far as I know. But we do have some issues with the bill. And I could go into some background on the regulation of signs along state highways. First of all, these are always signs that are on private property, not right-of-way. They're visible to a state highway, and because of that, the federal government and the state law that implements federal law requires that we regulate those signs. Billboards and other outdoor advertising signs, which are signs for compensation, need a permit. Oregon does have a capped permit system, as the former panel indicated. So signs that were legal at a particular point in time got permits. After that, no brand new permits are issued, but there are permits to relocate to different spots that are found to be legal. And that's the system we have in Oregon. And again, so it's there's quite a bit of federal regulation that we have to pay attention to. And if ODOT's sign regulation program fails to effectively control signs, we risk loss of up to 10% of our federal highway funds, which is quite a bit of money. And then in addition to those federal regulations, designing and building a highway and right-of-way acquisition is also heavily regulated by the federal government. So all that said, and as the chair read from some of my written testimony, what we do when we acquire a sign, my understanding is what we will do is pay for, we treat it, this sign, effectively as we do a business. We pay to take it down, we pay to move it, we pay to reinstall it. If it wasn't up to code before, we'll pay to bring it up to code, we'll pay to hook it up to electricity. So we essentially sort of reestablish that asset in a new location. We've found in the last 5 years, we've found in our records three signs that have been impacted, and of those, one could only really be called a billboard. The other two were much smaller business-style signs but fell under this kind of a regulatory scheme. That one billboard, my records show, received compensation on the order of about $100,000 for the land and the interest in the sign. The sign was reestablished as a better sign with two faces rather than one, and vegetation was taken down to improve visibility. So we do have some issues with the bill as drafted. First of all, it would require construction and engineering plans include billboards. Again, billboards are found outside of the right-of-way on private property. No other asset or interest has that kind of call-out in state statute. So we're trying to determine what the goal is by that provision of this bill.
Let me ask a question about that. If the billboard is outside of the right-of-way or the right-of-way to be acquired, why would it even matter?
Why would it matter? I'm sorry, Chair.
I mean, you're not going to, if it's outside of the right of way, mm-hmm. You wouldn't affect it. You wouldn't take the sign down, right?
Right.
So that would be actually a moot point, right? So one way or another, this legislation would not affect that.
Well, it does say that they have to be in the in construction plans. So it's calling out billboards to be put into construction plans regardless.
So
that's how the bill is drafted.
If the language was changed to say that in the proposed right-of-way, would that make a difference?
Sure it would. Yes, Chair. So the bill would also require that a sign, if a sign cannot be relocated in the same section of highway, then the state of Oregon must pay just compensation. Again, we treat these things sort of like a business and reestablishment. There's no other requirement like that in the law for any other kind of business that they be relocated in a similar geographic area. And again, the whole construct of the OMIA is about relocating existing signs. So it's unclear why it would get this sort of elevated treatment when we're relocating due to a project rather than any other relocation under the code.
Well, but there is... This is a little different. I mean, moving, you know, a tire shop to a different place would be one thing, but the value of a sign is really dependent on the traffic, I assume, on the traffic that goes mm-hmm. by it. So if it were saying to an equivalent place, I mean, that would make sense mm-hmm. to me. But, you know, just moving yeah. it anywhere probably in that aspect doesn't make sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do understand your point, Chair Beyer, and this brings me to another point that, if I can, come back to some of the other items that we have issues with in the bill. But I would say that the billboards are truly unique in the acquisition arena. Billboards are the only thing who only have value because of their proximity to the public mm-hmm. domain.
Yeah.
Houses, businesses, other things can be in other places, but the billboard only has value because of its because of the investment in the state in that highway, and I think that makes it quite unique. So some other issues with the bill. I think one item in the bill is an unintended consequence, but the way it was drafted is the bill would require us to pay compensation when we require the removal of a sign because it's truly illegal under the OMIA, the sign code, for some other reason. Again, I think that's inadvertent, but that's in the bill. But, you know, getting down to it and the point that the other panel made, the fundamental point of the bill, as we understand it, is to change the way we have treated billboards in this state since the 1970s and going to a construct of just compensation. And rather than treat it as a business and move it and reestablish it, we're going to pay for decades of ad revenue. And that's going to be a tremendous impact to the highway fund. And I come back again to that issue that billboards are truly unique creatures. So what in terms of solutions?
Now, why are you saying towards decades? I was reading this. If you were in normal appraisal of businesses, you don't use decades. You use revenue value of a couple of years. You're trying to evaluate a business.
Chair Beyer, it's I haven't seen the testimony of the industry yet, but it...
Neither have I.
Okay.
Other than what we just heard.
So I will tell you that my understanding of the way some other states treat billboards, the length of the advertising revenue calculated is very lengthy.
Hmm.
So in terms of what solutions, if not exactly this bill, then what? And we've had discussions with the industry and the representative. I think a couple of things can be done. One, and as articulated by the members of the earlier panel, we can improve our communication with the industry and the individual owners much earlier in the process. That does get to the point about the billboards in the showing up in the plans, and so when we're aware that a billboard could potentially be impacted much earlier in the process, we can be communicating with the industry and working with them on how whether we might avoid it or other options for helping them move that. But as always, you know, there are many factors to consider when deciding what feature to avoid when you're building a project. Do you avoid the home? Do you avoid the business? Do you avoid the billboard, the wetland, the cemetery? All of these things compete in that decision-making in that project building. We can also work on exercising maximum flexibility in interpreting both the state and the federal code in these cases. Again, the federal regulations are strict, and failure to abide by them can result in severe penalty to the state. But there is an element of discretion, and certainly we can work perhaps better with our federal partners on how we might, again, use maximum flexibility to assist in finding a new site that does meet code and is a similar revenue stream for the billboard owner. And again, then providing assistance to the owners in helping find a new site. The program, you know, contains maps and understanding of the regulations and can assist sign owners in locating a new site, and we can do a better job at that. So with that, we look forward to trying to work with the industry on coming up with a solution to this problem that is perhaps something short of what they're seeking, but more than what we're doing today.
I guess you're concerned about the federal government. I appreciate that. We don't really want to lose any. But it does appear that if the testimony is correct, that Washington and California have figured out how to do that. I think they both probably have more signs than we do.
Yeah, and Chair Beyer, what I meant with that was not, I think the former panel was talking about the amount of compensation they receive when a billboard does come down. What I was trying to reference was working with the federal government in maximizing the flexibility in that federal code and where a sign might be legal versus not legal, so that we can identify sites. So as they indicated, the best result is the sign either doesn't come down or is relocated to a suitable comparable site, and we can do more with our federal partners to find ways to help do that.
Yeah, good questions, Senator?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Barr. Excuse me. It doesn't sound to me like you have any problems with paying fair market value. The question probably lies in what constitutes fair market value. So do you have a problem with maybe agreeing on an appraiser and letting the appraiser and independent third party set the rate?
Chair Beyer and Senator Girard, I think probably the fundamental question is what valuation method is used. So I think there are some items to work through.
Yeah, I mean, in real property, depreciated value, I hate to say it, but I mean, in a house or a business, you know, the depreciated value might not necessarily be what the true market value is. And so I can understand where they're coming from with some angst that, you know, you could say, well, the wood's been up there 20 years. It's, you know, there's a depreciated value to that. But the revenue stream is such that it would, you know, constitute a higher value. What I'm asking for is I'm trying to find an agreement here, and I don't sense that ODOT wants to be a problem, but I do sympathize with the fact as to what free, you know, what the fair market value is if there's a takings. So
Chair Beyer and Senator Girard, I agree. We don't want to be a problem, and we want to find solutions. And I think working through with the industry what some potential solutions would be, we're trying to, among other things, you know, minimize the impact to the State Highway Fund, which is where this kind of money would come from. And how do we do that in a way that is fair and equitable to the property owner, but is again protecting that highway fund? And I think we can work together to come to some at least much closer than where we are today.
My perception is there may be some middle ground here, and I would actually, I think I cut somebody off who also wants to testify, but would you be willing to work with them and see if we can come up with something in the next couple of weeks that come closer? Because I do think there's some dissonance there that we may be being way overly restrictive. I agree with Senator Girard that just coined a depreciated value in this instance probably isn't fair.
Right. And Chair Beyer, Mr. Barrows and I have been working on setting up meetings already, and that is already in the works.
All right. Other questions of Amy? I would appreciate if you do that. Thank you, Amy.
Thank you.
And Mr. Zukin?
Yes, sir.
I'm sorry. I should have called Jeff before.
Chairman Beyer and committee members, my name is Chris Zukin. I'm the general manager of Meadow Outdoor Advertising. We've been in the Dalles since 1981. First of all, I want to say that I agree with Ms. Joyce. We have a great working relationship with ODOT. We work with them weekly, if not daily, and they're great people to work with. I've worked with Ms. Joyce for probably at least the last 10 years, and she's also great to work with. Very straightforward and easy to deal with. We have been discussing just compensation with ODOT since 2008. The 2007 legislature actually directed the industry and ODOT to discuss this and work something out. So we've been doing that over the last 10 years.
It's a long discussion.
Yes, sir, it is. and we weren't able to come to a solution, and that's why we're here, obviously, sir. Mm-hmm. A comment about the relocation. Ms. Joyce mentioned that ODOT offers to pay for relocation search and the actual relocation and reconstruction of the sign structure. That is true, and that's actually what we prefer. We would always prefer to relocate our sign than to remove it. The problem comes when we can't relocate it. There's nowhere to move it to in the general market area, either zoning or the lay of the land, what have you. That's when we have the issue and we start talking about just compensation. The state of Idaho's solution to that is in the event that a outdoor advertising sign is going to be displaced due to a highway project, they require a market search, and the billboard company must search within the market area to find an alternate location. If they can't, they go back to IDOT in this case, say we can't find a location. IDOT will sometimes bring in an independent contractor to confirm that there are no legal locations, if you will, in that market area. Once IDOT is satisfied that there are none, they paid the just compensation. So there's a diligent search for a relocation spot before any compensation is paid. So that's a model that has worked in the past, worked in Idaho. I guess I'll end this quickly. I'll just say we believe that fair is fair, property is property, and when your property is taken, you should be paid for it. And we thank you for your attention and your consideration of this bill.
So the question was raised of how many, if they're going to pay you compensation for sign, how many years would you think is reasonable?
I'm so curious. There are established evaluation methods for the valuation of a market value of a billboard sign. One is a revenue valuation. It's a formula. It very simply is usually a multiple of 5, 6, or 7 times the annual revenue, less than a decade. That is actually being phased out now, and they are now using more of a cash flow or a net profit formula, and that multiple is somewhere in the 8 to 9 times range. So it's less than the gross revenue. It's basically take out the major expenses and apply the multiple to the result.
Well, I hear you've been doing it for 10 years. I guess I'm going to ask to take another shot at it.
Another week.
Or, yeah, whatever is necessary. There. We're going to be here for a couple of months.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. That's all I had signed up. Is there anybody else? Seeing none, we don't have the materials to move the bills today anyway, so just a little longer. So we will close on that, and we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 173. Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 173 extends the sunset for the tax credit for reservation enterprise. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm on 176. I grabbed the wrong file, Mr. Chair. This one's completely different. Extends the sunset for a tax credit for long-term rural enterprise zones until June 30th, 2024. We have received both the fiscal and revenue impact statements. It is a no fiscal impact statement. And because this has a subsequent referral, Mr. Chair, to the Tax Credits Committee, it has a revenue light hall pass statement, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
No amendment.
There's a what statement?
Chris.
That's a hall pass. It's just basically
and Art, later. You want to start?
No. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Chris Allenack, Legislative Revenue Office, and I was asked to just come and provide a couple-minute overview of the tax credit review process. I think most of the members are familiar with it at this point. I did submit from the recent tax credit report some relevant information on these two tax credits, along with policy questions that have been circulated, if the committee chooses to go that direction. And so it's pretty much similar as has been done in the past. These are just standard sunset extension bills, and it's up to the chair and the committee's discretion to modify that policy and review that policy in any way you see fit. And then, if so desired, move the bill on down to JTAX, the Joint Committee on Tax Credits. The idea here is just the pure policy discussion about whether or not it's the right policy question in place and whether the tax credit is structured as achieving that policy goal. And then any modifications you may choose to make to it. And then kind of that discussion without the weight of the revenue impact discussion per se, and trying to separate the policy review versus the cost, which would largely be handled in JTAX. This tax credit is a little bit unusual because of the low number of claimants and the public nature of how the tax credit claimants can be certified via through the governor's office. We run into a disclosure problem and not being able to disclose tax return information, basically because the number of tax claimants is too small. Mm. So that's a little bit different from most of the tax credits.
So I don't know whether I should ask you this or Art this. I'll throw it out there. Can you distinguish between this one and the other enterprise zone applications, the sort of vanilla non-residential? How does the rural one differ?
Steal your thunder.
Take that one, Art.
I will. Chair Beyer, members of the Senate Business and Transportation Committee, it's a pleasure to be here. My name is Arthur Fish with the Oregon Business Development Department, otherwise known as Business Oregon. And I'm here just to kind of give you a better background and understanding of these two credits. Looking at the long-term rural enterprise zone program, it is a very distinct program from what the chair may be thinking of, which is the 3 to 5 year, what we call standard exemption, which is used by literally hundreds of companies around the state. In enterprise zones generally, and I don't want to, you know, confuse you and get you off of that, if you think it's about property taxes and a bunch of local governments, over 100 cities and stuff, then you're right. These are really exceptions to what the program does. And both credits are very, very narrowly and you know, circumscribably used. And we have another income tax credit related to e-commerce, which is itself very narrowly and somewhat constrained, but it's much broader than these even. And in this case, you have two programs or two elements of this long-term program, which again, getting back to the chair's question, it's very distinct from the property or from the standard program. And so businesses get certified, they enter an agreement with the local sponsor to get up to anywhere from 7 to 15 years in property. Property tax abatement, of which we have, you know, some good data about. And then if with the governor's approval, they can, with a income or, yeah, corporate income tax credit can be attached onto that, which is what we're talking about here. Provided under current law, the local agreement is done by, what, June 30th of 2018 or something, and this bill would take that out to 2024. So, I think that answers your immediate question, but I'd be happy to offer further explanations.
So it's got to be how much? What's the minimum investment?
There are some minimum investments for these. They vary by location. So along the I-5 corridor, it might be $25 million or more to use the program. In some small rural counties, it might only be a few million, but in most cases, it's at least $12.5 million to use this program. And we've got about, say, about 10 users, and less than half of them have gotten the governor's approval for the credit.
So the distinguishing feature between this one and the regular regular tax credit is the regular tax credit, we're only talking about local governments deciding to give up part of their property taxes for 3 to 5 years. Mm-hmm. This one, in addition to the local governments giving that up, if the governor approves, they get a relief from the corporate income tax? Is it only corporate?
Correct. The difference, the base case is a property tax exemption, and then this one is the corporation tax credit.
This is a corporation
tax. This is the credit. This is just the income tax piece.
Yes. Go ahead.
And I was going to say another unique feature of this tax credit is for taxpayers who claim the tax credit, the taxes, 30% of the taxes that they do remit are redistributed back to local taxing districts.
Say that one more time.
So if a corporation is eligible and claims the tax credit, now there's a threshold. They have to pay at least the tax credit can only be used to offset their income taxes down to $1 million. So they can't use it to eradicate all of their income tax.
Okay, so it's similar to the strategic investment program.
There are some similarities, yes. Okay. So they'll be using the tax credit, and they will be paying some amount of corporate income tax. That amount, 30% of the amount of corporate income tax that they pay, will be redistributed back to the taxing districts in that area.
Yeah, Chair Beyer, members of the committee, yeah. They are getting a property tax exemption, a fully locally discretionary one of anywhere from 7 to 15 years, and on the facility of one of these businesses. And essentially, this has only been done in only four counties so far. If the governor authorizes it, then the corporation can use this credit. It's calculated based on their gross payroll, but really the limiting factor in their use of it, and only 0 to 4 companies might be using it, would be that they have to pay so much tax.
They have to pay the first $50 million in corporate tax.
So the SIPanalogy is apt, except this is income taxes, not property taxes.
So, and over the $1 million, then what's the percentage that they have to pay in taxes?
Well, the taxes will be determined per the normal structure. The tax credit is 62.5% of payroll at the site.
Yeah. I'll make sure I understand this. The credit can only be applied above the first million?
Right, above the first million.
And a part of that tax credit that an amount of that taxes that they would otherwise pay goes to the local governments?
Chair Beyer, members.
Am I confusing
you? This is another wrinkle in this that I wasn't going to volunteer, but they pay the minimum, okay? Maybe
they
up
pay
to
$1 million. We
and
got
then they
that.
Can apply the credit against the remainder of their tax liability based on a ratio of the facility versus whatever else they do in the state. The 30% that might be returned to taxing districts, that's based on the taxes they actually do pay. So that would come from, if they're actually claiming the credit, it would come, and using some, it might come from the first $1 million. So that's the amount that is potentially returned.
Oh, I see. So that we lose out on the first $1 million too. 70% of it.
Yeah, 30%. 30%
of it.
30%
of it.
Got it?
I'm afraid so.
Huh?
I'm afraid I do, yes.
Okay, and so far it's only been 4 companies?
Well, there's only been a very limited number that
qualify.
That
I don't know if
business that the governor has authorized for the credit. And then, of course, we don't have a whole lot of companies that are using the property tax program generally. I mean, it's a much more specialized program than the standard exemption.
So, for example, there are, I think, 9 companies.
Yeah.
Participating in the property tax exemption, and that information is public. It's on the website, and it's included in the documentation.
In this property tax program.
Right.
As opposed to the regular property or enterprise zone.
Well, all that data is available, too.
Yeah, but yeah.
Yeah, I get that. Yeah. I know it's available.
But for purposes of this, trying to get at the why it's non-disclosable is that you have the 9 companies who take advantage of the property tax, and that's public. So if somebody wants to know, they can, you know, it's one of those 9 companies.
I get it.
And so now you're starting out at that list, and it's very easy to, or it could be, to get at who is claiming the credit. And unrelated specifically to this tax credit, there are very stringent non-disclosure tax laws. So that's why the revenue impact is non-disclosed at this point.
Okay. Anything else?
Chair Byer, members of the committee, I'm here for questions, but I think we've covered a fair amount of the of this long-term program in this respect.
From the state's perspective, do you have any opinion on how effective this has been?
Chair Byer, members of the committee, I mean, obviously we don't have a great deal of vast experience, and the property tax abatement is clearly the main driver in terms of incentivizing or inducing some of these projects, but even though it might not be that readily usable and very complicated and all that, it does seem to resonate. It is an attractive factor because of the high, you know, headline potential of the credit and the fact that it's an opportunity to use, to use payroll. And so I think ourselves and some of the rural local sponsors, and it is a very rurally oriented program. We can get into which counties aren't even really in the program at all. It is a value, I think, in that respect. But, that's about all I can really say.
Do you have a but-for opinion on those that have been granted, the professional opinion? Would the project have happened without it?
Without the Chair Byer, members of the committee, I would gather that that some of these facilities would not have occurred without the program in general, if not any of them. How much the tax credit was an important factor, or at least the potential that they're using it. So, don't understand that I'm saying they have actually used it, but I think in Boardman and in the Dalles it was, and probably in Douglas County, though, probably less likely they could have ever used it. But I think it was a factor. Beyond that, I really can't be certain.
Only asking for a professional opinion.
Yeah.
It's hard to do development in rural areas.
Yes.
Other questions to these guys? Chris, while you're here, I'm just wondering, I do have a question, and it's not open, but I'll just ask it anyway. On 176, the reservation credit, my understanding, and I guess I want to know if I'm correct, is that the Senate Revenue Committee has already removed the sunset on that program?
I'm just
wondering if this is moot.
There is a bill, Senate Bill 145, that moved from Senate Finance and Revenue down to JTAX, and that bill proposes an elimination of the sunset date.
It has not been passed.
But it went down.
It has not been passed. It's moved to joint tax credits.
And I believe it was moved without recommendation.
Without recommendation.
Without recommendation.
Right.
Okay. Thank you very much. Gentlemen, thank you. Let's see. Who else do I have? Jody. Jody Weiser.
Good afternoon. For the record, Jody Weiser talking for Tax Fairness Oregon. So I want to say one thing about what I just heard. The long-range rural tax break, the enterprise zone, you always hear it's 7 to 15 years. And this program can be up to 15 years. I've never seen anything but a 15-year program. So that it isn't really 7 to 15 years. Everybody gets 15 years of no property taxes. And if we're guessing correctly about who might have received the income tax blessings in addition to property tax blessings, at least one of them is probably saving $12 million a year in property taxes. When a company saves money in property taxes, 41% of that money is yours, because it's K-12 funding. It's not like you're not participating in that local decision about giving away property taxes, because you're giving up 41% of every dollar that isn't received. And so that makes us really question this really complicated program from which we are not able to receive any information, except that it's fewer than 5 businesses that have applied for it, not whether they've used it or anything else. And so it seems like if you add up the costs, it looks pretty deep. The best source for understanding the program, I believe, is on page 24 of Chris Allenek's document where he brings up one example of one business that, you know, he's given you a hypothetical, obviously, not a business that he would not reveal any one business a situation. And he gives an example of a business that owes $2.5 million in income taxes. So they're doing something that they actually get paid for at this facility, whatever it is, and they get paid rather handsomely for. They have a payroll of $900,000. So they're not paying property taxes for 15 years. And for some number of years, we don't know because we aren't given access to that information, they're also not paying a good portion of their income taxes. In this case, the example in the book, they're given, out of the $900,000 salary, they would get a tax credit for $562,000. So basically, the public is paying for most of the people working there with that tax credit. Their taxes aren't high enough that they can use all of that money this year, but they can carry it forward to another year. And so
it's on their website.
We've lost out on the property taxes, and now we've lost out on $500,000 worth of income taxes. And then in addition to that, we're going to turn back to the community a portion of the income taxes that we do receive. And why we're doing that, I don't know. It just somebody, you know, put it, rolled it into an idea, because that's not going to incent the business to come to that community. There's no incentive for them to have that give back. And most of the businesses that we suspect are getting this are paying high franchise fees and other things to the local community, so it seems really generous. I would think that this would be something you could end, and it probably wouldn't hurt a whole lot. The governor has her fund that she can make grants out of, and the businesses might have gotten that kind of money in addition to this, and we don't know anything. And if you're going to continue it, I think you should say if a company wants to continue to get this benefit in the future, then we need disclosure so we can talk about it. And I would ask specifically for this kind of public disclosure. Each type of tax that has been paid by that business, including state income, property taxes, franchise fees, or whatever, for that particular property, not just for all of their properties in the state, but for that particular property that you're making this kind of abatement for, and their total payroll and total compensation and the number of employees on the property. Because that's the only way you can evaluate whether this is something you want to continue doing 5 years or 15 years from now. And if you don't get this information and you continue it, in 6 years you won't know any more than you know now. And that's not the way to be making the kind of decisions that gives away the educations of our kids, for all we know, and the education of the kids of the employees at these facilities, wherever they are. Thank you.
Thank you, Jody. Questions? Senator Drott?
Yeah, I think I have to kind of a little bit disagree. Rural Oregon is really, really hurting. I mean, and so if these credits were up in Portland, I would agree with what you're saying. But you talk about we're losing out on taxes, but these industries or businesses most likely by the testimony wouldn't have gone there. So that we're not losing out on anything by having them go there. They create jobs. Which is real hard to create in rural Oregon. So I'm just trying to figure. I understand the transparency part, and I would agree with you on that. But tell me, if they're not going to go there, you don't lose any tax.
I understand what you're saying, and I'm guessing, okay? I'm guessing because we don't know. My guess is that we've provided this at Google and at Facebook, and that each first data center. And because it's supposed to be for the first jobs of a business doing that type of project. And those same businesses are in Eastern Washington as well. Similar kinds of facilities. And we only have two kinds of taxes to give away, property taxes and income taxes. In Washington State, they can give away property taxes and business B&O taxes and sales taxes, and they do tend to give away the sales taxes. Well, we've given away sales taxes. They're not paying any sales taxes on all that really expensive equipment. And so I don't think we have to go this far. We're getting these kinds of businesses. But we don't really know. You know, we really don't know. And so it's like, well, how do we act without knowing? And why would it be important to not reveal to us who we are that's getting this kind of benefit? I don't understand why that disclosure would matter.
Jody, I guess I would agree with you on the disclosure. It wouldn't be bad to have more disclosure on it. And certainly, if it was voluntary, if you want to use the program, you volunteer to do that, which is a more or less an exemption from tax policy other than that. So there is a potential around that. If you want the credit, you have to expose some. But I would argue with you that I don't think we're losing a lot if there's only been four applications in 7-10 years, something like that. So it's not a big deal there, and we do have some balance on it in terms of the governor has to approve it.
Right.
So we do have some control on that, and it's been a long time, but I spent many years trying to do development in small rural communities, and I'll tell you, it's really, really hard, and the areas that I was working in was close to a metropolitan area, so it's not like Primeville or some of these other places. I think that's really, really hard to do that, and
right.
I don't know whether they used it or not. But
we don't know what it's costing. See, I think if it helped get Google
almost
and Facebook
worth paying
to
them
start,
to go to Primeville.
Yeah,
and frankly, if that's what we have to do to get something to happen in the rural areas, it's probably almost worth it. They do pay good wages. There's not huge employment if you're talking about server farmers. But if you're in Primeville, you know, 25 or 30 jobs is a whole lot.
I think they actually have quite a few more than that.
I think they do too.
Yeah, and no, I think if it's really helped, it makes a difference. But we have a right to know.
Yeah.
And there's no doubt that once you start getting an industry, you shouldn't have to keep incenting it. We're now a popular place for data centers, so maybe we don't need to continue to incent it. We're now a popular place for data centers.
Well,
we've got quite a few.
That popular.
Right? No, we are.
Very.
We are.
We have more of them that are showing up in the urban areas than in the rural areas now.
Well, that's true.
But I think it's a difference in the size.
Right.
According to the Amazon lobbyist, their own facility, their own data center is in Seattle. And they have one in San Francisco, too. It costs a lot more to put your data there than it does in rural Oregon or rural Washington. And so they have their facilities in rural Oregon for the people who don't need that rapid access or aren't that wealthy, probably, you know. But they're important projects.
There are a lot of reasons for that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Senator. So, Mr. Chair, we have two choices. We can either move it along to JTACS or not.
Yeah.
Those are our choices.
That's correct.
I think we should decide what we're going to do and go on.
Mr. Chair, we have a second. We have another choice. We can move it along without recommendation, or we can move it along with a positive recommendation.
That's true.
Well, that's true.
Well, that's before we talk about that. How about if we see if there's anybody else who wants to comment?
That would probably be good.
Thank you, Jordy. Is there anybody else who wishes to address this issue? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing. We will open a work session, and the chair is going to use the prerogative, and the chair would move that we move this onto the tax credit committee with a recommendation that it be renewed and that they consider the need for more transparency in the process. Discussion. Is there any opposition to the motion?
Chair.
We have one.
Mr. Chair, for clarity purposes, the motion to move it to continue the sunset would be a do pass recommendation on this.
Okay.
Sure. We should at least clarify that.
Okay. So it is
or without recommendation, but it's one of those two.
With a do pass recommendation.
Yeah.
His vice chair would have said that. Okay. He's smarter than the chair.
No, I didn't say that.
Is there any opposition? We have one. Senator Monroe is opposed. We'll close the work session on that one. And are you folks here to talk about 176? There's a whole bunch of people in the audience. No? We have it scheduled. I'm going to open a public hearing on 176. Patrick?
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. We can go ahead and bring that up, too, as well.
Uh-oh. That's a fire alarm.
Fire alarm.
Noisy.
Everybody outside. It's raining
it's
out
okay.
There.
Fill a tax credit. There goes that tax credit.
Can I go and get my
There you go.
We're on.
Well, she can't hear very well. Her ears hurt.
All right.
Go ahead.
You can gavel back in, Mr. Chair. Oh, you want me to go ahead and talk?
I never gaveled this out.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 176 extends the sunset for the tax credit for reservation enterprise zones until January 1st, 2024. As subsequent referral of the Joint Tax Credits Committee, has no fiscal impact and a hall pass revenue light impact statement, Mr. Chair.
Is there anybody who wants to make public comment on this?
It's going to be Chris.
Oh, jeez. We already heard from them.
Yes.
No public comment? Okay, we will close the public hearing, and we will not move to work session because they already have a bill down there. We will adjourn.
Oh, no, no, we don't. What? No, we won't adjourn. I don't. I think you want to undo that. We have an informational meeting.
Those people in the back of the room. Oh, is that what those people are here for?
The people in the back of the room are the economists.
Oh, we're back open.
So, yeah. So I think technically he gaveled before he said it, which means it doesn't count. So.
Oh, we did.
Oh, my God. Oh, I didn't realize we had an information meeting. Oh, the highway cost study.
Yeah.
Yeah, we got to hear that. We got to hear that.
Give them 3 minutes. 3 minutes?
We have to hear that one.
3 minutes?
Bummer. Bummer. So watch this. I'll get called.
No, you have to listen.
Where are they?
What committee you have to go to?
Leah, I thought it was your job to watch with the economists. Where'd they go?
They're all hungry outside.
You lost your people.
Carl, where are your fellow travelers? Are they out there? Okay.
Hey,
what?
Me and John's been saying he's been trying to get Stan for children.
Hey, Mason, come on down.
Sorry, Mason.
We're opening a public informational session on the highway cost study. Mason, come on.
Okay.
Are the mics on yet?
Yeah, they're on.
When I see that light,
My cousin in Canada.
Come on,
listen.
Madam Malik with Legislative Revenue Office. Today we bring you the highway cost allocation study results as item one of this informational hearing, and then at the end we will also add the flat fee study results. But the highway cost allocation results this time around, we've had a different process, a more abbreviated process. We will have my colleagues talk to you about it, but this basically would be the tool that we would use as you're discussing
up.
And getting transportation package. This is the tool that we would use in order to be able to put together a balanced constitutional package. I would like to introduce the rest of the panel. I have Mark here. He's our state economist, and Mark is the one who is legally mandated to contract and lead the study and put together the study review team. So I'll leave it in his hand.
You're not used to being in this hearing room. You used to be in the next one.
Yes, Senator Beyer, always A. I don't know why that is. But thank you, Mazin. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Mark McMullen, the Oregon State Economist, and chair of the Highway Cost Allocation Study Review Team. So all of you are familiar by now, having been around a while, with the Highway Cost Allocation Study. I'm here to fulfill our constitutional requirement to present this to you every 2 years, and this is the 20th study that we've done. We're kind of held up, or the Department of Transportation at least is, as a model across states in terms of this being the state of the art of this sort of thing. And what is this sort of thing? What the Constitution requires is that we make the highway funding as fair as possible. And what it means by fair is it means that the share of fees that are paid or taxes that are paid by light vehicles in terms of predominantly gas taxes and in terms of heavy vehicles predominantly with the weight mile tax, that's proportionate to the amount of costs that they're putting onto our roadways.
I can't find stuff.
And so the upshot in this biennium is that right now our system of weight mile taxes and gas taxes are pretty darn close to fair as it stands right now. Now, unfortunately, we can never say it with certainty because it's a moving target. As we change the mix of traffic between heavy trucks and light vehicles, and more importantly, the mix of construction projects, that can change. And in this particular session, when we're considering a large transportation package, it's likely to do so. What we have as the basis of this study is the Department of Transportation's recommended projects for the biennium. As the legislature is to change that, this could change significantly. In particular, to what extent does the legislature put money into the things that heavy vehicles do more damage to, pavement, bridges, the like, rather than more general investment, signage and things that are more allocated evenly across all vehicle types. So what makes this study work in particular is our the vendor that we go through, Echo Northwest, who has done several of these studies for us now and has a great deal of expertise. And we also get a lot of support from the team at ODOT, as well as Amy Williams at DAS, who does our project management. And they make it work, but what really does also help is the study review team. And this is really the guts of the study, where we get together with stakeholders and academics and go over all the technical assumptions that go underneath this. Now, underneath the study, and it's a very technical study, very dry in a lot of aspects, but there are real dollars attached to this. You know, some of these technical assumptions really do move the needle in terms of shifting cost responsibility between the cars and the trucks. So there is real implications here, and as a result, the stakeholders take it very seriously, and our stakeholders are very very savvy and have and very good at exploiting these things. But at the same time, they would much rather debate things like pavement factors and the technology behind putting in culverts, in our offices rather than in the policymakers' offices, where they have limited time in front of you and all, and have bigger fish to fry at that point in time. So before I pass it over to Carl Batten and Echo Northwest to talk about the details of this study, I wanted to bring up some study review team members. We have our most senior member is on his last page of testimony next door on the diesel bill, so he should be popping in a second. But we have our newest member as well here to make some comments about the process, Garrett Kransky from the Bicycle Alliance.
Well, thank you for that introduction, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. Indeed, I am the junior most member on the study review team, and this year's exercise was, for me, primarily a learning experience. But I'm here to verify that, in fact, we do have a team of brilliant economists who are minding Oregon's Constitution and the costs that go into maintaining our roadways and the expenses that are borne by the people that are using them, whether they're driving light vehicles or heavy trucks. And I am truly impressed at the level of specificity that goes into this effort in terms of understanding the damage on their roads, where that damage comes from, and the usage rates and the amounts paid in. So I don't have much substance to offer. A lot of this stuff is above my pay grade, as they say. But it's been a really, illustrative experience for me. And indeed, we do meet every couple weeks, every couple months, depending on when they've got more material. And there are a lot of tough questions asked and good answers provided. So it's a robust process and one that I definitely support.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Chair Byard, members of the committee. I'm Carl Batten from Echo Northwest, and we're an economics consulting firm based in Portland, Oregon, and are contracted to do this study. This is the 20th study. The first study in Oregon was conducted in 1937 by Condi McCulloch, the engineer who designed all the nice bridges at the coast. He also was good at math and did the first highway cost allocation study. Oregon has done more of these than any other state, and we believe does a better job at them than any other state. And since 1999, there's been a study for each legislative session. The Oregon Constitution requires that the study be conducted, and that if the study finds that the contributions don't match the costs imposed, that the rates be changed. The exact wording of the Section 3A3 is on the screen there, but it can be summarized as, are the shares of revenues paid by light and heavy vehicles fair and proportionate to their share of costs? And the way we go about answering that question is by constructing equity ratios, which are the ratio of the share of revenue that a vehicle class produces to the share of cost that that vehicle class imposes. And if that ratio is one, then they are that vehicle class is an inequity and is paying its fair share. If it's more than one, that means it's paying more than its fair share. And if it's less than one, that means it's paying less than its fair share. Oregon's approach to highway cost allocation has been developed over the decades, and the way it works is that it's a forward-looking approach. We're looking at whether we believe the upcoming biennium will produce equitable results, the cost to allocate or the budgeted expenditures for the upcoming biennium. We include the expenditures of federal funds because those are generally interchangeable with the expenditures of state funds. And if the funding balance were shifted between federal and state for one particular category of funding, that could change the results of the study if we didn't take into account both of them. We also count the expenditures by local governments of state highway funds and the expenditures by local governments of federal funds, and some of the expenditures of local governments of their own funds. The local government owned source funds that we exclude are those that are dedicated to particular purposes and are not interchangeable with state highway fund monies. This little chart shows how the expenditures are spent. The height of the blue bar tells you how much was spent, including the federal and local funds. And then there's a little note on top of each bar, what proportion of that height of the blue bar is coming from federal funds. As you can see, the more construction-oriented categories have a higher proportion of federal funding than some of the others, notably maintenance is pretty much entirely state funded. And then the category called other, which is administration, safety, preliminary engineering, and planning.
What's the scale of the 100 to 600? Is that 100 million?
Those are millions of annual dollars.
Okay. And the percentage then would be the percent of the blue bar?
Yes.
That's federal funds?
Yes. So we calculate equity ratios for the upcoming biennium based on our forecasts of miles of travel and expenditures and revenues. We use ODOT's forecast put together by Dan Porter. For the for the and we do it for the 2018 calendar year, which is the middle 12 months of the upcoming biennium, and we assume that the 6 months before and the 6 months after that calendar year will add up to about the same. The forecast is for 35.7 billion miles of travel by light vehicles, which are vehicles 10,000 pounds and under, and 3.1 billion miles by heavy vehicles, which is everything heavier than that. The expenditures are as forecasted in the agency request budget, and as Mark pointed out, those could be different under a package. And the revenues are assume the current law revenue instruments, and again, those could be different under a package as well. I'll point out that the model we use allows us to estimate the effects of different revenue instruments. At the time we were doing the work, there was a possibility that Measure 97 would have passed, so we did include in the model a prediction of what effect that would have had on the revenues and expenditures. This graph here shows how vehicle miles of travel in Oregon have changed over the last several years. The gray area is the recession, and you can see that the miles dropped fairly drastically during the recession.
Wow.
And have been recovering since about 2014. One thing that if you dig into what's happening with this, since about 1999, the vehicle miles traveled per person in Oregon has been declining. So as population increased, the total vehicle miles traveled held fairly steady. Since about 2014, not only has the population continued to grow, but the economy has recovered, and it looks like the miles traveled per person is increasing again.
Do you have that segmented someplace in your database of how much of the growth, and that's pretty rapid growth, how much of that is result of people driving more, how much of it's a result of just more people?
In the last biennium study that looked at that and dived pretty deeply into the different trends going on. We did not update that for this study, but it's clearly the miles per person are increasing as the economy has recovered.
I think the Global Warming Commission looked at that and was talking about BMT going up substantially.
Yeah, and if I may, Senator Beyer, we have the same chart we developed on a per-person basis, and yes, it is growing. It's not back to its pre-recession peak, but about halfway. So looking at
that's in terms of miles per person.
Per person, yeah, vehicle miles per person. Same timing, though. About 2014, we started to see rapid growth, and like I say, about halfway back to where it was before the recession.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
And during that same time, fuel prices have been increasingly lower, which has got to have some impact.
Yes, Senator Beyer and Senator Monroe, there's behavior, there's more jobs, but clearly the timing is more than a little suspicious that we started seeing this rapid growth right after the fuel prices dropped. Now, before that, in the early stages of the recovery, we did see quite a bit of growth in vehicle miles traveled among the heavy trucks. The heavy trucks started recovering earlier, and we had in keeping with manufacturing activity and the like, and only in recent years now it's been taken over by the light vehicles, and that's what's driving this. Driving is a bad word, but that's what's behind this rapid growth in recent years.
Doesn't hurt when you've got in 1 year 27,000 people moving into the Portland metro area.
Yeah. So putting it all together into the final equity ratios, we found that the equity ratio for light vehicles was 1.0076, indicating that they were expected to overpay by less than 1%. and the heavy vehicle equity ratio was 0.9865, indicating that they were expected to underpay by about 1%. Again, these are based on forecasts of mileage, of expenditures, and of revenues. The margin of error on all of those forecasts makes us unable to say that these are different from 1.0.
So rough numbers then, light vehicles pay for about two-thirds of the costs and heavy vehicles one-third of the costs.
For the total, yes.
And that's a fair share. That's their fair share of the costs based on the construction. Senator Monroe.
Do you take into consideration the fact that some of those light vehicles run about 5 months a year with studded tires?
Chair Beyer, Senator Monroe, there is a specific component of the model that looks at the costs imposed by light vehicles through the studded tires. And the way it works in Oregon, the whole process only looks at expenditures rather than true costs imposed. So what we look at, we ask the Oregon Department of Revenue to conduct, or I'm sorry, the Oregon Department of Transportation to conduct a special study of how studded tires affect their expenditures on roads in Oregon. They completed that study as part of the prior biennium's highway cost allocation study, but their estimate extended out into the future. We use the appropriate years from that study's results this time, and we do account for the expected expenditures due to repairing studded tire damage, and we also extend that to an estimate of what the local governments spend on repairing studded tire damage as well.
Good. You need to. Thank you.
Any more questions? Or
I think there's presentation.
No questions.
Yeah.
Senator Dodd? You stated that we have to do this study every 2 years. Is that by statute or by the Constitution?
Okay. By the Constitution.
Yes, Senator, this is a constitutional requirement. And however, there is a section in the law where it specifies that it's DAS, the Department of Administrative Services, that leads the study and reports to you. And it emphasizes that Senate and House committees dealing with transportation as well as Senate and House committees dealing with revenue. So Senator Riley is going to hear this one more time. He's the lucky senator between you. But basically that, and one thing that we usually do in these studies, every once in a while we do an abbreviated study. This is one of them. Usually sometimes we bring you a whole type of research and white papers. In the past, we brought you things of how the efficient fee could work if we are to price roads in an efficient way. We also brought you a paper on how the highway fund would react under the scenario of a carbon tax of some sort. We've also brought issues such as electric vehicles, different ways of VMT growth and so on. So this go around, we don't bring any of these issues or research because we did not do that. This is the abbreviated section or the abbreviated time when we've done this. I think probably next time would probably not be that abbreviated. It would be, you could expect a lot more time if you're, I'm sure, eager and waiting for those studies to do.
Sorry, just to add, there was a request by the study review team that the next study include a deeper dive into local and county spending in terms of some of the numbers, in terms of what the truck's cost responsibility is on these local roads. So we're going to take a little deeper look into that next time.
And Mr. Chair, there's one more thing we would like to also. This is not a constitutional requirement, but a legal requirement. A few years ago, you've asked the Department of Transportation to report to you every time on what's so-called the flat fee study. The flat fee is for the trucks that pay on the flat fee schedule, and they ODOT does that every 2 years. So we ask them to come and take this opportunity. It is a very quick report to tell you how they found these flat fee studies to be comparable to the trucks that pay the full fee or the weight mile tax fee. So we'll ask Dan Posner. Thank you, Colin.
I will be brief. Vice Chair Thompson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Daniel Porter. I'm an economist with the Oregon Department of Transportation, and I'm here, as Madison said, to give you a report on the 2015 flat fee study. This is not constitutionally required, but is statutorily required that we conduct every 2 years and report to you on the findings of the study. So it's done as part of the HCAS overall process, but the question that it seeks to answer is different from the HCAS question. So it's not looking at equity ratios between light and heavy vehicles. Its question is specifically getting to, are the flat fee rates revenue neutral with the weight mile? So the goal is that an average carrier that would pay the flat fee that they would pay on average, the same amount of flat fee that they would on wooden weight mile for the commodities that are eligible to be use the flat fee method. So the goal is that if you can do one or the other, you wouldn't have a competitive advantage to choose flat fee or weight mile. What's a flat fee? So it's really simple that a carrier that's eligible to use a flat fee, it's an annual program you sign up for. It's the commodity rate that's set in statute multiplied by your combined declared weight of the vehicle in hundreds of pounds, and then you divide it by 12 to pay in terms of monthly. So it's not based on the miles you drive, it's based on the weight of the vehicle. The idea was that you had specifically log haulers who are making multiple trips a day. They're traveling a lot on private property that is then not taxable miles. This gave them a simpler reporting option. It was set in 1949 when the first flat fee was set for log haulers. So it's been around a long time. And as you can see from the slide, that logs as a commodity, it's predominantly the one that's used. So in 2015, the three commodities that you can choose are logs, sand and gravel, and wood chips are the three. So logs is the one that's used the most, and about 70% of the revenue from these commodities are from the flat fee method versus the weight mile. And sand and gravel is the other option, and it's only a small percentage of them use a flat fee, predominantly because they haul other things besides just sand and gravel, which then require them to have pay the weight mile. So if you're going to pay weight mile for that, then it's probably easier just to pay weight mile for the whole thing. And then wood chips is the other option, which are, again, no currently carriers who use this flat fee method for wood chips. So context, if you look at and see the combined, the weight mile and flat fee together, the weight mile represents 97%. Flat fee is only about 3% of total. So it's actually a little over $8 million, a real small chunk of total revenue for this. And then getting to the actual results of the study, ODOT doesn't do it itself. We contract out with the researcher from University of Albany, and she's been doing this for a long time, so we have, and using the same methodology, so we have this consistent method which then we can compare results from one study to the next. So this is giving you the last three studies, so you can see the blue horizontal vertical bar is the sand and gravel revenue neutral rate. So this is what they would be paying if they were revenue neutral with weight mile. And the green one is for, so the blue is for sand and gravel, the green is for logs, And then the horizontal lines are the actual statutory rates right now. And you can see they're really close together, so it's hard to tell the difference. It's 759 is what the statutory rate is for log haulers, and 753 is the statutory rate for sand and gravel per 100 pounds. So you can see in 2011, 2013, not much difference. They're very similar to each other. But now in 2015, both the revenue neutral rates came down. So that sand and gravel are still underpaying. So their rate should be 869 to be revenue neutral instead of what it is at 753. But they're not overpaying as much because essentially we're getting less miles and less revenue from them. And then for logged, similar story, we're getting less miles from them, not as much revenue is staying about the same, we're getting less miles. And I think that probably if you look at like a forecast or actual harvest board feet for timber, you can see 2015 was a lower year than 2013. And so that kind of explain why maybe the log trucks are taking less trips, so they're getting less miles, but they're still paying the same rate, so their revenue neutral rate dropped. But this was presented to the Oregon Transportation Commission, and they recommended that this would be the rate changes that you'd put in the statute to go to make them revenue neutral. So it would be 869 for sand and gravel and 703 for log haulers. So with that, I'll take any questions you might have.
See any questions?
Thanks well, thank for you for reports. Having us,
Mr. Chair.
That is it, Mr. Chair. Thank anything, you for asking.
Anything from the audience? Or adjourned?
Mm-hmm. Oh, you do a good job. Oh, you do a good job.